Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Communities and countries around the world are now declaring that we are in a climate emergency. Most of these declarations focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and the more comprehensive resolutions also call for a just transition, meaning that frontline communities that are bearing the brunt of climate chaos will be given priority in addressing necessary mitigation. But meanwhile, the oceans are rising, and even if we are able to drastically cut back carbon emissions within 10 years, the seas will continue to rise for some time into the future. So what we'll be facing, no matter what, is how to adapt to a new inland coastline. Today we talk with Jeffrey Peterson, who spent four decades working on environmental policy with the EPA and the U.S. Senate, and has written a new book, A New Coast, Strategies for Responding to Devastating Storms and Rising Seas. Jeff, welcome to Locus Focus.
Yes, great. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I want to start by talking about what you mean by a new coast. I mean, that sounds kind of exciting in a way until you realize that it means that some part of what we know as the coast now will be left behind.
Well, I think it has to be clear to people that the future for the nation's coastline is going to be very different from what we've known for the last several decades or even hundreds of years. We expect that sea level rise and storms will push the coastline considerably inland. It'll depend a little bit on geography from place to place and the elevation of different parts of the coastline. But over the next 50 to 100 years, sea level rise, looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 feet or perhaps more of sea level rise, will push the coastline far inland and make America look considerably different.
I have this memory of when I was a kid and I read a lot of books about dinosaurs, and there'd be these maps of what the world looked like back in the year, in the time of the dinosaurs. And one of the things was that North America was much smaller, was much less land, much more ocean than it is now. And so it sort of, when I think about the future, I keep going back in my mind to those maps and all about dinosaurs that I read in 1956. So one of the things that I think we hear a lot about sea level rise, it's kind of in the background noise. I don't think I really got a handle on what it meant until I was at a conference a number of years ago and saw slides of what they call sunny day flooding in South Florida. And I'd seen maps of that Florida was mostly going to disappear by 2100. But when I saw those maps of what's actually happening now around Miami and that southern tip of Florida, it brought it really home. So how are we already experiencing, to some degree, this new coastline emerging or maybe submerging?
Well, so we are seeing sunny day flooding more consistently as each year goes by. Places like Miami, it's pretty obvious. You see water in the streets during high tides, not even an exceptionally high tide. Other communities, particularly along the Gulf and East Coast, are facing this problem. Norfolk, Virginia, for example, has similar high tide flooding. But as we also add in factors like storm surges, and we can see flooding as a result of big major hurricanes, like make the evening news, with their major storm surges of 10 or more feet. But smaller storms that are more local and that get more local coverage from the news can also generate a smaller storm surge, and even a foot or two of storm surge on top of a high tide is enough to push water into many communities around the country. If we're looking at the future, say, of 4 feet of sea level rise, which is very possible by 2080 or 2100, we could have as many as 500 communities all or partially facing flooding virtually at every tide.
I want to get back to that whole idea of sunny day flooding, because for one thing, I think people here in the Northwest maybe don't have any idea what we're talking about. How drastic is the flooding, for instance, in Miami? I mean, I saw these slides, and this is about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was this block of really nice brand new homes, and they had for sale signs, and there was about 2 feet of water, and it was going, it was not just on the sidewalks, but you could see like it was probably going into the basements of these houses. The person who was doing the slideshow said, hopefully when people actually came to look at the houses, the flooding wasn't going on. But which brings up a whole lot of issues that you cover in your book. But first of all, how extensive is it? I mean, when we talk about a sunny day flood, what does it really mean? And how much water do people find in their communities?
Right. So a sunny day flood is usually associated with the occurrence of a high tide. And depending on the time of year, you might get a somewhat higher tide. So in Miami, I think we've seen something like a foot or sometimes even 2 feet in the streets in downtown Miami and surrounding areas. At the same time, I think it's important to say that the city and surrounding jurisdictions have recognized that this is a problem and are working hard to make what steps that they can make to deal with this flooding, including investments in pumping and different kinds of water management practices that will minimize these effects. So we're seeing both the natural evolution of the problem as it continues to get worse, and as communities build in their responses, some of the effects are addressed for at least a short time.
Well, one of the images that I have, again, of these photographs in South Florida, which shows another issue that you deal with in the book, which is basically a lack of equity that's very prevalent in our society. In downtown Miami and in the wealthier neighborhoods, there is more pumping. They also have these kinds of contraptions that they put up, I think, so people can, they have elevated sidewalks so people can walk above the water. Whereas in poorer neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods of color, you see people trudging through a foot and a half or 2 feet of water wearing knee-high boots. So what does that say to you about some of the issues that we have facing us in the coming future?
Well, I think social justice is going to be a really critical factor to consider in the coming years as local communities, with the help of states and the federal government, come to grips with not just the effects of storm surges and hurricanes, but the continual gradual rise in sea levels. So it's not just the pumping and the elevated sidewalks. It's major coastal infrastructure investments like seawalls, where they get built, how high they get built, what communities are protected, and how do you make those decisions. It's been pointed out, for instance, that the traditional way of determining whether to make a big investment, particularly a federally sponsored investment, has been to use cost-benefit analysis, which is just a way of looking at what the economic benefits of a particular project will be compared to what it looks like it's going to cost, and tending to want to spend money where there's a positive cost-benefit ratio. So when you look at the coastline, it's often the case that the wealthier parts of communities have the higher property values. And so when you try and evaluate the benefits in economic terms, those areas tend to score higher than parts of communities where property values are lower. So just the natural operation of a cost-benefit analysis would tend to steer investment dollars toward the more wealthy communities. And one of the most important things communities with state and federal guidance can do is really think beyond that simple cost-benefit analysis and factor in the importance of having protection that applies fairly and equally to the entire population along the coastline, not just to the parts of communities that can go out and buy it themselves, or where a cost-benefit analysis would otherwise point an investment.
Well, another issue that seems to happen is that in a lot of areas where they're going to be experiencing or are already experiencing severe flooding, like New Orleans, which experienced intensive flooding, of course, after or during Katrina, but also has had a lot of flooding in the past year, that the lower-lying neighborhoods in New Orleans and in other parts of that part of Louisiana are actually the poorer neighborhoods, and the higher more wealthy neighborhoods are a little higher elevation. And I think that there are quite a number of coastal communities, particularly in Southern California, wealthy communities that are right on the coastline and in the danger of being inundated. But do you have a sense of how much the percentage of communities that are low income that would be impacted compared to the ones that are higher income?
Well, there have been a few studies looking at this, not nationally, but in some areas, some particular areas. For instance, along the Gulf Coast, there was a study that identified roughly 20% of the population as being economically disadvantaged. But, of course, it depends a lot on how much impact the extent of the impact you're looking at and what your definitions are of economically disadvantaged. But I think it's clear that a significant portion of the population living in areas that are at risk of coastal storms and rising seas are economically disadvantaged and will need help to cope with the many problems that come with coastal flooding. It's either storm-driven or increasingly, as seas rise, becomes an everyday proposition.
And that's another issue.
There's also...
Go on.
Well, there's also been some work looking at the immediate impact of disaster response policies in terms of social justice. And you may have heard about issues along that line in the response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico, but there's also evidence that on a more systematic basis, the federal dollars that come following a major coastal storm to pay for relief and rebuilding tend to get steered toward parts of communities that have more to start with in the first place.
Yeah, so it's not just Houston versus Puerto Rico, but it's actually neighborhoods within Houston as well.
Yes, I think that's probably right.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Jeffrey Peterson, who's author of A New Coast, Strategies for Responding to Devastating Storms and Rising Seas. It seems that there's quite a bit of disparity, too, between the amount of inundation from sea level rise that different parts of the country will experience. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking, well, you spent a lot of time in the Northeast and in the Southeast and the Gulf Coast. You talk about California, you talk about Washington, you don't mention Oregon. And so I was thinking, I'm pretty familiar with the Oregon coast, and I was imagining how far sea level rise would affect a lot of the cities on the Oregon coast. And most of them are there's very few cities, for one thing. And the second thing is a lot of them are on higher land. And I kind of go by the tsunami zones, which we have very well demarcated now because of the great concern that we're going to have a major earthquake sometime in the maybe not so distant future. But I wonder why Oregon wasn't on your radar, and maybe if you're familiar, what's the difference between the development patterns, particularly in Southern California, but even in the San Francisco Bay Area, in the Puget Sound area, and then in Oregon?
Right. Well, the couple things to say about the Northwest. If you look just at the storms risk, the big hurricanes that generate the huge damages that we've seen in the last few years, in 2017 when we had three major hurricanes hit the Southeast and Gulf Coast, generating hundreds of billions of dollars in impacts. That's likely to continue in the years to come and be more severe because storms are projected to be more severe. The West Coast is less likely, the West Coast of the United States is less likely to have those huge storm impacts and the storm surges that drive further inland the bigger the storm is, and then in future years will ride on a higher sea level. So you're fortunate in that respect. You're also fortunate in the respect that sea level rise, when you read the news stories, often what you'll see quoted is estimates of global average sea level rise. And global average is, of course, an effort to look at the entire ocean world and say, what do we think the increase is going to be? And it varies when you break it down by region and country. So it just so happens that the Gulf Coast of the United States and the Atlantic Coast of the United States happen to have some of the more significant, higher than average estimated future sea level rise. That's partly due to factors related to ocean currents and tide and different effects, but also land subsidence. It's a good thing from the point of view of sea level rise that the Northwest has less risk of land subsidence than really almost any other part of the country.
I see. Why don't you explain what land subsidence is for people who don't know what that term means?
Well, so as coastal areas are developed and as building occurs and groundwater from aquifers along the coast is pumped out and geology responds to rising sea levels, the land will actually subside. So the sea level rise that is experienced in the years ahead and is already today is partly the result of the sea level actually rising because glaciers are melting and Antarctic ice sheets are melting. But it's also partly a response to the gradual subsidence of coastal land areas. And when you have the land subsiding and the sea level rising at the same time, you're getting the effect of is greater than if you just had sea level occurring and the coast itself wasn't moving, subsiding, going downward, if you follow me. And in some places, in particular Alaska, we're seeing some actual the coast isn't so much subsiding as it is either holding steady or in a few places actually rebounding. So if every coast were rebounding, sea level rise wouldn't be as big an issue. But unfortunately, along most of the American coast, we have a combination of sea level rise and land subsidence making a coastal flooding problem. That's kind of the 1-2 punch. And you add storms on top of that, and you get a lot of land area that has traditionally been dry is going to be turning wet.
Well, also, as I imagine, the Oregon coast is a good part of the coast which has cliffs very close to the beach and mountains that are close to the cliffs. How does that affect it? I mean, it seems that if the ocean is going to rise, could that change that kind of topography, or does that protect us in a way from having sea level rise inundate further inland?
Well, so those land features generally protect you. You will be seeing perhaps loss of some beaches or wetland areas, and there is a question about how successfully wetlands and beaches can migrate in response to higher sea levels, migrate inland. And so on the one hand, a cliff landform or mountains, as you say, gives you elevation to protect you from storms or sea level rise. On the other hand, those landforms can also be a harm in the sense that they prevent, say, a wetland system, ecosystem, from migrating inland as sea levels rise because there's too much elevation and a landform that wouldn't accommodate a landward shift of a wetland or a beach even.
And why is that significant? I mean, what role do the beaches and the wetlands, coastal wetlands, play in kind of creating the world that we're familiar with?
Well, of course, the coastal ecosystems writ large, wetlands, beaches, dune systems, are all important to the ecology of the coast. Fisheries are dependent on those systems. And in addition, while there are important ecological values at risk here, some of these landforms, particularly beach systems, are important for recreation and for tourism. They provide a destination for people who want to get to the shore and enjoy fishing or swimming along a beach, and the potential loss of those long-established beaches to rising waters and the loss of access to those beaches as waters rise will have some pretty big effects, not just ecologically, but in terms of the recreational use and the economic value of the recreational use. That has been studied, I think, probably more extensively in California, where beach systems are really important to the whole functioning of tourism in California and play a very important economic role for coastal communities.
I'm having this image. I live right near the Willamette River, and this is, I mean, kind of a microcosm of what could happen at the coast. But when the river rises and when we have high water years, the beach disappears. And then the water goes into the park that's right by the beach. And so far, in my time of living in this neighborhood, it hasn't gone into the neighborhood per se, except for the buildings that are really close to the river. And yet people come down there and they will come down when there's no beach and when the water's in the park, and they'll say, "I thought there was a beach here." And I think that there's this disconnect. People really expect the beaches to exist. And when they don't, they sort of are in disbelief rather than sort of looking and realizing the water is high. And that, to me, brings up the whole issue of getting people to understand what's going to be happening with sea level rise. So how do we get people to understand that what we are familiar with and cherish could disappear, and that we need to be addressing that before it happens?
Well, there's so much we can do to improve the information that's generally available to people and to help build understanding about what the macro level risk for the country are, but also what the place by place impacts will be. One of the things that would really be a big improvement is if we could do a better job with just disclosing the information that is now available, but not readily in a form where most people can access it or even have occasion to see it. So one example is the flood maps that are developed by the as part of the flood insurance program by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Well, they're not as complete as they could be with respect to just regular flooding. Many of them are out of date. But more importantly, right now, they don't include any information about sea level rise. So anyone who even thinks to ask a question about, well, maybe I should look into what my flood risk in this is here in my coastal community. When they go to look at the most immediately generally available government set of maps, the flood insurance maps, they're seeing old data, and they're seeing estimates based on flooding that do not include future sea level rise. So that's something that we could do much better with. Another opportunity to help educate people about the risk is if we would be a little more forthcoming in real estate transactions when a coastal property, a home, for instance, is sold. We could more consistently disclose what the flood risk is, not just from conventional storms and storm surges, but also in the future for future sea level rise. And a few states have adopted some legislation that would go in that direction. And actually, Congress has adopted a requirement for some additional disclosure, but just of flood risk, not actually looking at the sea level rise risks. So we're getting a little better about that, but there's a lot more that we could do, and making sure that when people are making a financial contribution or a financial investment rather in property or home, that they see the risks that investment will be facing, not just next year, but 20 or 30 years from now.
Well, in your book, you talk about changing a mindset, basically, that a lot of communities, or probably almost all communities, think of flooding in terms of something that happens and goes away, whether it's a storm surge or whether it's the river rising during a lot of rain or snow melts in the mountains. What's the difference between that kind of experience of flooding and what we would be experiencing in the near future from sea level rise?
Well, the storm surge flooding that most people feel that they live along the coast, they've seen storms in the past, they have a mental image of what their risk is, and you can explain to them that, well, a warmer climate is going to make storms more intense with more rainfall and greater storm surges, and they can kind of calculate that in their mind. But it's been really, I think, hard for people to get a better sense of what sea level rise is going to do. And the whole future of sea level rise is, I think, going to be an eye-opening experience and force people to really think hard about whether they should be making an investment in a coastal area, and what alternatives they have for protecting their investment, whether that's encouraging their community to build a structural protection like a seawall, or whether it's to harden their own buildings and infrastructure so that things like electronics and air conditioning and other support systems for a property are elevated above a particular risky flood zone area.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and we're talking today with Jeffrey Peterson, who's author of A New Coast: Strategies for Responding to Devastating Storms and Rising Seas. Well, you mentioned these different responses to the impending sea level rise, and so far you've mostly been talking about basically barricading ourselves against the onslaught of the ocean. But there are also, in your book, you talk a lot about the need to retreat from the coast. And a few months ago, I had Elizabeth Rush on, who wrote a really wonderful book called Rise, which looks at communities that are being faced with needing to relocate and the struggles with that. So I want to talk a bit about that, but within the same context of looking at what it would take besides moving a few vacation homes further inland, what it would really mean to move entire communities away from the sea. And I think back to after Katrina, and when I, and at that time, I'd only been to New Orleans once, didn't have very strong feelings about the city, and wondered why people lived below sea level. And then shortly after Katrina, I visited New Orleans and got a much deeper sense of the culture and the vibrancy that was like being snuffed out by the inability of people to return home. And this seemed to be an injustice about saying, well, people should leave New Orleans because it's too low. So there seems to be like a lot of issues about relocating people. So first of all, I want to talk about the reality of being able to protect ourselves through man-made and natural barriers. And at what point do we have to acknowledge the only thing we can do is to move inland?
Well, it's a very complicated problem, and it's going to be a challenge for states and communities all along the American coast and really along coastlines worldwide for many years to come. There are a couple of different things to keep in mind when thinking about whether to try and invest in holding the shoreline right where it is and protecting everything where it was built over the years, or whether to step back from the coast. And clearly, you know, I think it's hard for almost everyone to get to really embrace the idea that coastal communities and even large cities that exist right now along the coast will, in decades and certainly in future centuries, need to come to grips with much higher sea levels and what the best strategy is to do that. Initially, I think we're going to see relocation in a kind of a, you might think of it as a rifle shot kind of way. We talked earlier about disclosing some of the risks so that people have better information about them, the risk of flooding. And as that happens, I think people individually will make decisions about relocating themselves and stepping back, either taking a property that's right on the water now and moving it back on the property to a place on land that they own that's higher elevation. That's one simple thing. Or perhaps simply selling the property and moving to another area that they think is less risky, both from the point of view of flooding, but also from the point of view of the financial loss that they might be incurring. And we are beginning to see some data now in terms of home sales and the value of homes that are right on the water. Some gradual declines in some of the values of those properties. In particular, investors who are buying property are more inclined to look really hard at some of the long-range risks. And so those investment decisions are tending to sort of steer away from coastal properties. So there is some relocation happening kind of in a one-off helter-skelter way. But secondly, there are communities that are looking hard at the question of what to do about the coastal flood risks, and they're evaluating their alternatives and thinking about whether to make an investment in a coastal protection structure like a seawall. In some cases, there are seawalls already in place, and the question is whether to build a seawall higher. In other places, there is no seawall, and it would be a new investment. And seawalls, honestly, do have a reassuring engineered permanence to them. They seem attractive. They're what most people think of when they really come to understand the risk that they're facing from storms and rising seas. But seawalls have some big downsides as well. For one thing, they're hard to size them right, because a bigger seawall will work better and work for a longer period of time, but the bigger the seawall, the more it costs. And it's almost always the case that cost is a constraint. Another problem is that once you get into the seawall strategy, you go down that road, there is a tendency to feel like you need to double down on it as seas rise. If you build a 3-foot seawall and that works for 20 years, that may be a good thing, but then the seas start overtopping that and you need to go back and rebuild it again. And you can get into a long-term kind of downward spiral that ultimately ends in having to move back anyway, move back to higher ground. So there's reason to wonder whether that might have been a better strategy to begin with. Another problem with the coastal protection structure or the seawall approach is that they do cost money, and to the extent that state and local governments are paying for these, there's a run. You run the risk that money for that coastal protection project is going to come out of the school budget or transportation or housing services. So because of the high cost and because of the risk that the cost of these investments is going to drain the ability to provide other services, you have communities, or you're going to certainly have communities, making hard decisions about not just how high to build the seawall, but how big an area to try and protect. And that gets back to the question we were discussing earlier about, do you just protect the high-value areas where the cost-benefit analysis would sort of suggest that you could spend the most money and get the biggest benefit, or do you also need to protect less economically well-off parts of the community? And I think most communities would say, well, we do want to protect the whole community, and that just means, well, okay, now we need not just a higher seawall, but a bigger, longer seawall. And then how do we afford that? And if you say, well, geez, the federal government should help us with that, and maybe the federal government would. But as seas rise and storms get more severe, lots of communities may be asking the federal government for help with big construction projects like seawalls and beach renourishment.
Now, what about, I mean, one of the concerns that I have when all this talk about seawalls, which we've been hearing a lot, particularly since Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast, now 7 years ago, that it overlooks the other possibility of returning to much more natural landscape along the shores and letting nature absorb the storm rises, the storm surges, and the sea level rise. And of course, that gets us back into more relocation. But one of the things I was hoping was going to happen in New York City after Sandy was that they were going to not rebuild in some places, and they're going to let the salt marshes return on Long Island and in Lower Manhattan, even in Staten Island and New Jersey. But my understanding is that, you know, they're going to build seawalls. So wouldn't it, if we could think more long term, wouldn't we be thinking about doing more of what we call out here green infrastructure, as opposed to just kind of building hard gray infrastructure?
Well, I think natural infrastructure, green infrastructure, is a great alternative, especially in the near term, for dealing with particularly flooding associated with storms and storm surges. The sea level rise presents a little bit of a different problem, and it can... Protecting areas and preserving, for instance, wetlands and salt marshes can help slow erosion, and keeping those areas intact may mean that sea level will be a little less likely to eventually be a problem for a community. But eventually, rising seas are going to overwhelm those natural areas. With luck, those natural areas, salt marshes, wetlands, and beaches, will migrate inland where they can do that and where they're not prevented by human-built infrastructure or natural features like cliffs or headlands. So there are some benefits to using that natural approach, but when sea level rise is going to move over those areas and eventually impact built communities and other areas, either a built protection like a seawall or relocation is often the better solution.
Well, I want to think about, you mentioned infrastructure earlier. I want to think about the infrastructure that is along the coast, much of the United States, besides having cities and the other city infrastructure that goes along with that. We have oil refineries. We have nuclear power plants. We have LNG facilities. We have all kinds of stuff that's highly toxic. And if we're going to be moving inland, what do we do with all these facilities that we really don't want to have underwater, which is one of the scares every time there's a hurricane or in the Gulf? You know, there's a lot of concern about all the oil refineries and the whole oil infrastructure around New Orleans and off the coast of Texas. And then when beyond that, what do we do about all these plans that they have, particularly out here in the Northwest, to build massive LNG and methanol facilities along the coast in places that are going to be inundated, in one case in Tacoma, underwater by 2050? So how do we address the infrastructure that's there that needs to be removed, and then how do we change the mindset so we stop building more of that?
Well, as you say, the first thing and most important thing to do right away is to be much smarter about where new facilities are located. And so making investments in energy infrastructure, and it's not just energy, it's transportation infrastructure and water systems and things like military bases. To the extent that it's possible to relocate those to, or to locate them in the first place, if you're building them new, in areas that are not at risk of storms and rising seas, we should be doing a better job of doing that. Then there's the problem of dealing with everything that's been in place right along the coast in risky areas and is going to face a flood inundation scenario in some number of years down the road. Some of our infrastructure, coastal transportation, water systems, other energy systems, are right now at risk. Others are located in places where they will be at risk many years down the road. What I've suggested in the book is that we need to think hard and take a hard look at what our long-term plans for these facilities are, and that those efforts to look at our major infrastructure sectors like energy and transportation and military assets, there be planning for that led by federal agencies working with states and local governments, so that we have a good long-term plan, not just about how those infrastructure assets will be adjusted and moved inland as seas rise, but how that's going to occur in a coordinated way with relocation of communities, and how do we not, we don't want to build a community in a place that isn't served by transportation and electric power and sewer and water services, for instance. You have to fit all those things together at a place that is not at risk of storms and rising seas. And fitting all those different pieces together is a major planning job. The good news is that we do have some time. If we start now, don't put new facilities into those risky areas, and start planning now to how to think about where those new places are going to be that are safer better served by relocated transportation and utilities and other services. In the case of the facility you mentioned, major oil and gas or other facilities, those do pose hard problems, and to the extent that some facilities are essentially a water-dependent use, ports, for instance, naval bases have to be on the water. We have to really think hard about whether the places where we're talking about those facilities going really will sustain them in the face of rising seas and storms. And so much of what's been done so far has really not included that kind of long-range risk assessment.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with Jeffrey Peterson, author of A New Coast, Strategies for Responding to Devastating Storms and Rising Seas. Well, as I was reading your book and reading your very thoughtful plans for how we, or strategies for how we plan for this and how we take all the next necessary steps in the right sequence to basically relocate our current lives along the coast further inland where they would be safer in the impending time of sea level rise, which we know is going to happen. We are faced with a political administration federally and in a lot of state levels and local levels, which is in total denial, not just about sea level rise, but of climate change itself, that it's human caused. And I'm thinking in particular there, I mean, Trump every day last week was trying to roll back another environmental protection and just kind of drive the world into oblivion. And so I wonder how do we deal with having a responsible and a pragmatic strategy for dealing with this when we have on the federal and local levels so many politicians who are making the decisions and unwilling to look at this and, in fact, are moving us in exactly the opposite direction?
Well, you're absolutely right that this has been a particularly discouraging last several years. Clearly, there's much more now. We now know so much more about the risks that we face, not just from storms, but particularly from rising seas. But even in the last 10 years, during the Obama administration, there was a pretty concerted effort to think hard about not just climate change and reducing greenhouse gases, but what the country would do to adapt to all the changes that a warmer climate would bring, including risks like sea level rise. And the Trump administration has essentially revoked almost all of that effort. And not only do the things that the Obama administration was working on, for instance, there was something called the Flood Risk Management Standard developed by federal agencies that really would have been an excellent sort of precautionary step in terms of new development and looking at making sure that it was 2 or 3 feet above base flood elevations, things like that, that were revoked by the Trump administration. But traditional programs like the Sea Grant program, which does so much for educating people about all kinds of issues along the coast, and the Coastal Zone Management Program, the National Estuaries Program, for which there is a National Estuary there in Oregon. All the funding for those traditional programs that had support from administrations going back many, many years was cut. So that was very discouraging. And the Paris Agreement, the decision to withdraw from the Paris Agreement really was perhaps the most fundamentally damaging. But there are a lot of things that people can do to help advance the case for better response to coastal flood risks. In particular, helping your local community take a look at those risks. For instance, you might people might want to go and just, if they haven't looked at the flood zone maps that exist today for the flood insurance program. As I said, they're not out of date. They're not fully up to date in most places, and they don't include sea level rise, but they still give you an idea of the area where you live that may be at flood risk. So it's worth thinking about that. There are community organizations that do a great job of putting important things like flood risks on the local agenda, and supporting those is always valuable. And of course, Congress, I think, could do a lot more and trying to bring these issues to the attention of Congress, as well as state and local elected officials, would, I think, also really be helpful.
Well, one of the concerns that I have is that here in the Northwest, we are spending so much time fighting these massive fossil fuel projects, all going into flood zones. And we need to, and particularly in communities like Coos Bay, Oregon, which is a very marginalized, pretty impoverished area, which has some brilliant people who are thinking in terms of, you know, doing offshore wind generation and doing all kinds of very creative things to bring back the economy and the life of Coos County and that part of Southwest Oregon. But they spend most of their time fighting the Jordan Cove export, LNG export facility, which is a gargantuan. It's totally will be inundated within just, you know, probably 30, 40 years. Same thing in Tacoma, where they're fighting myriad projects of oil and gas and all kinds of other stuff that is going into their port, which is going to be underwater in 30 years. How do we have time? I mean, it seems to me that people are making a choice right now that they have to fight off the worst things that haven't happened yet before they can even start to think about resiliency. And so that's just a frustration that I'm putting out. But I wonder, you know, what other ways are there that we can both be building resiliency at the same time that we're fighting off really stupid ideas?
Yes, I totally appreciate that there are there are multiple dimensions to this fight. It's particularly frustrating that that oil and gas type facilities, particularly new ones, are being located in coastal areas where the warming of the planet that those facilities are contributing to is likely to create a risk to the investment and to the potential harm due to storm damage and related issues to the ecology of the surrounding area. So I think really it's important to think about being vigilant, to be cautious, and make sure that developments that are water dependent are designed as well and as thoughtfully with a full appreciation of risk in mind, at the same time that we think about what the broader implications of a warming planet are going to be, and try and think hard about what we can do to make sure that the coast that everyone grew up with and has lived with up until now and grown to love is still around in some form that we hope will, as much as possible, resemble the coast that we have today, at least in terms of its benefits and values.
Well, Jeffrey Peterson, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's great. I really appreciate talking with you as well.
Okay. We've been talking today with Jeffrey Peterson, who's author of A New Coast, Strategies for for responding to devastating storms and rising seas. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, to start off the new year, we'll do a State of the Fossil Fuel Struggle with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with an old Robert Johnson tune sung by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening, and have a happy new year.
You may be rich, you may be poor, you may be young, you may be old, but when the Lord gets ready, you gotta move. You may be high, you may be low, you may be down, no place to go, but when the Lord gets ready, you gotta move. You gotta move, you gotta move, you gotta move, child, you gotta move. When the Lord